Hello. Welcome to this week's Mood Swings. We're back with a guest. You'll be pleased to hear. You don't have to just listen to me ramble endlessly on like you have had to the last 2 weeks. Yeah, it's really good to be back with a guest. It was absolutely brilliant recording this one. And my guest this week is Lynn Shaw, who is a local dancer and choreographer, if I pronounced that right, who recently did a dance show, a dance trio, as I learned, a short film, and a Q&A, all was sort of together as part of a show called Dancing on the Borderline, which is all about her own experiences with borderline personality disorder. I don't know anything about dance. I know a little bit now, but still not very much. But I don't know. I was going to say I know a lot about borderline personality disorder, but I don't know if that's strictly true, but I've read a lot about it. And as you'll hear in this episode, it's something me and Lynn discuss about my feelings towards it and how I think it's possible something I might have. But we speak about loads about that throughout the episode, so I don't need to go into it just now, really. But since we came back from my wee break, I've been thinking, I don't think we've had a really raw mental health one like this one is. That's not to say that other guests weren't great. I think maybe the one with Abby would have maybe counted in that category. In fact, yeah, that would have, but I mean, that seems like a long time ago now because I recorded it quite a while before it came out. But in recent weeks, I suppose, the one with Scott Strathdee was very much based in his music, and mental health came in and out, and we spoke about a number of different topics. And then the one with Paul McBain, obviously a lot to do with MMA, and then likewise with Peter Scott, a lot to do with Muay Thai, and just the mental health stuff was sort of spattered throughout those podcasts, whereas this one is an hour of us speaking about borderline personality disorder, addiction, I guess, and a whole lot of other things. And yeah, it was incredible to meet Lynn, to speak about her project, and just to get to know her a bit. She was definitely one of these people that you sit down and start speaking to and you feel like you could be there all day. I definitely felt like that. So those are my favourite episodes to record. I'm thankful for a lot of them turn out like that, if not most of them. But yeah, it's safe to say me and Lynn definitely got on, and I really enjoyed recording this episode. Anything else to tell you? If you are friends with Lynn or a fan of, you know, of Lynn's work, and that's why you've come across this podcast, please go back and check out old episodes. I don't think I've had any dancers on, but I've had I'm trying to think who, I mean, I've had, we speak a little bit about 10 Foot Tall Theatre, I think, and this one we've had them on with one of their shows. They had the cast and the crew sort of all did a podcast. That was a long time ago now, but still a good listen, I think. Who else have we had that might be of interest to you? Loads of sports people, MMA fighters, Muay Thai fighters, Liam Harrison, Rich Cadden, Shane O'Neill, Russell Anderson, the footballer. I don't know if I've just said him a minute ago. Loads of folk, loads of creative art, people from the creative arts as well around Aberdeen, and loads of poets. So if you're into creative arts or whatever, go and have a listen. And also, maybe a shout out, because this episode is about borderline personality disorder. It's certainly stuff that's something I've touched on before in podcasts. So if you want to listen to this, listen to more about that, I would suggest episodes with Molly McLachlan, Madian Sangu, Rebecca Clark. I don't know if we talk about it, use that term, but it's certainly something me and Rebecca have discussed before, and I'm sure there is mention of it, although we recorded those podcasts quite a long time ago and there was quite a lot of wine involved. But I certainly think that if you enjoy this episode, you might enjoy those ones. And go get me on all the social media. So it's 365 Aberdeen on Twitter and on Facebook and on Instagram, which is my favourite place to communicate. Is Mood Swings Abs ABZ. We get quite a lot of new followers, so that I think are genuine and not just the bots that I usually get. So that's good. Anyway, I need to stop rambling on. Please enjoy this episode with Lynn Shaw. Cheers. Actually, my friends used to all live in Ferry Hill, and they used to call themselves the Ferry Hill Boys.
Yeah.
I don't mean it like a youth level. This was
no.
In their 20s, they used to just be like, oh, it's the Ferry Hill Boys.
Yeah.
Which I always find a bit ridiculous. I lived just in the city centre, not far.
Yeah.
I never got to be part of the Ferry Hill Boys.
Damn.
I know, I missed out. But anyway, I'm here with Lynn Shaw. How are you doing, Lynn, today?
I'm good, yeah, really good. And you?
I'm fine. I'm very cold. I think this is the coldest day we've had so far.
It's freezing.
Yeah, I'm not prepared for it.
No.
I went to the shop earlier and thought, it's quite cold today. And then I walked here, which is a little bit longer, and thought, I just didn't equip myself. Even that short walk didn't prepare me.
No, it's the wind and the rain, and yeah, it's hitting winter hard.
I know. So we got in touch through a weird set of circumstances we discussed, but I saw an article about yourself at the Evening Express. Knew that I wanted to speak to you, but completely forgot all the details. Couldn't find the article again, and then someone, one of your pals, recommended that you can follow me on Twitter. It popped up on my Twitter, and I was like, that was who I was after, and immediately we got in touch. But it was primarily to speak about your project, Dancing Along the Borderline.
Yeah, that's right. Like,
I always, whenever I do one of these things, I always mess up the key point, the key name or something. I always call it something, so I was worried there. But no, Dancing Along the Borderline.
Dancing Along the Borderline, yeah.
How long ago did you start that process?
So I've been a dancer, I trained as a dancer many years ago, and I'd always wanted to complete my master's. So when I was studying at the Royal Conservatoire, I was doing a MEd in learning and teaching in dance. The first seminar, one of the students had done the course the year before, had done a short presentation. And she kept saying, you know, choose something meaningful to study because you're going to be doing this 3 years part-time. Yeah. And it was quite a bespoke course, so you could do anything that you wanted. And so in my head, I kept thinking to myself, I wonder if I could marry my experiences of borderline personality disorder with my experience of dance. And that was the first time that I thought I was ready to kind of explore those issues, my own issues, through dance.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad that I did. So actually what happened was I got in touch with an old friend who was a film director, and See Me Mental Health and Glasgow Film were looking to commission 4 short films that were based on somebody's mental health experience, but kind of storytelling in a creative way. So we met up and we did a short dance documentary which was filmed in a warehouse in Glasgow.
Okay.
So it was really rustic and it was based on the creative process. So it wasn't a finished dance piece. It was a documentary about exploring movement through the symptoms that I was had experienced through borderline personality disorder.
So was that the 12-minute documentary that went on to be...
Yes.
In the show.
Yes, that's right. So the show, so I've done a couple of different shows. The show that I did in Aberdeen was a trio, a live trio, followed by the film, and then was 2 presentations by mental health lecturers at RGU.
Okay. Is that the same guys that do the film thing?
Yeah, the movie, mental health movie.
Yeah.
Like Dan Warrender and Scott McPherson.
Yeah, and they give talks after the...
Yeah.
Okay.
But they are brilliant. They're so supportive of the arts. Mm-hmm. And I met up with them a year ago. I was doing research online. And Dan was doing... Both of them are doing their PhDs at the moment. Mm-hmm. And Dan's focusing on crisis intervention and borderline. and a Scots working on film and substance abuse.
Okay.
So I was like, oh my God, hello. Yeah, so I was like, emailed them going, can we meet? So, and then I went to see one of their films, and you know, they host these sessions where you can speak about the themes of the film, which is based on whatever mental health issues there are. And they are amazing advocates. So it's been really great working with them.
Yeah. What film did you go see that they put on?
Oh, the one about the multiple personality disorders. Now I can't remember.
James McAvoy.
Yes.
Split.
Split. That's the one. That's the one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Quite a sinister film.
It's really sinister. Like, whoa. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I think it's great what they do with the films, because it gives you a chance to kind of, it's really relaxed and laid back, and you get to discuss the topics. And
yeah, I've not actually been to one. I have been meaning to go, and I think they're doing one at the end of this month, a film that I really like, and I've seen the date and I've kept meaning to check whether I've got something on.
Yeah,
I can't remember what the film is now, but yeah, I actually did a couple of podcasts that were movie based before. Well, sort of, and I found out what they were doing after was sort of similar. They're not recording it. And I felt a bit bad that I've stolen their idea.
Oh.
But yeah, I've done a couple of them as well. And that is a really interesting way to investigate mental health, is through film, because it occurs more, I think, more than you.
Oh, absolutely.
Would
yeah, I think film's really accessible. I also love the fact that they're big supporters on how the arts can be a therapeutic way of either raising awareness or therapeutic way of healing.
Yeah.
And Scott really talks about the spirituality, because it is a spiritual journey trying to heal, because you have to come to lots of, you need to have acceptance, and sometimes you need to let go of things which are kind of sometimes trauma that's kind of ingrained or embedded in you. There is this kind of healing, spiritual healing that has to take place in order.
Just heading back to the presentation thing, just you said you did it's a trio, I think. Is that a trio of dance? Is that?
Yeah, it was trio, so it was three of us.
Okay, all right, okay, right.
Yeah.
That's why I didn't know this, like, I don't know that much about
dance. Oh, I know, it's fine, yeah.
Okay, yeah, so there's a trio. Who else was involved with the project?
So, it was Errol White and Davina Given, and they have White and Given Dance Company based in Edinburgh.
Ah, okay.
And I've known them for years, and we just had a week where we explored kind of different themes of borderline and created like a short kind of piece. Because for me, the film is really great, but it's very much edited, you know, to see. So it's pulled together.
Yeah.
Whereas a live dance, I think it's visceral, and it's
yeah.
You can feel it and see it when it's live.
Yeah.
And I think it gives it different layers to the film. And I think both are equally as important, but the live element is exciting.
How long was the live piece?
It was just 14 minutes.
Okay.
So it was kind of like short nuggets. You know, 14 minutes of the dance, 12 minutes of the film, and then 20 minutes of each presentation, and then a Q&A.
Yeah. There was a Q&A with yourself?
And the dancers, and Dan and Scott.
How did you find that? Do you mind, like... Well, obviously you're sitting here speaking to me, but it's different, I suppose, in front of a live audience. How do you find that process of being asked about, I suppose, both dance and then a dance that's based on your own experiences, very personal? How do you feel that?
Yeah, I think that's the most important bit, actually, because I think that it's easier to say, or it's easier to talk and explain to an audience, because I also, the film is really self-explanatory, but the dance isn't. So sometimes, especially if you're not from a dance background, you're like, what does that mean? Because it's contemporary, so it's...
Yeah.
So at least you're able to say, well, this is how we look... That section that you watched there was based on trying to be invisible. So that's why the body was kind of curled in. And I think that then the audience get a better sense.
Of what they've just seen, yeah.
Yeah. And you don't need... And the thing about contemporary dance is you don't need to make sense of it all. And in fact, you might see something really... You might see something differently to the person sitting next to you because of your own life experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So it might remind you of a moment that you, God, that reminds me of when I was a child or a past relationship, or another person might be thinking that reminds me of a cooked breakfast I had. No, I'm joking. But I don't know why I said that. So Yeah, so it's good for them to know where that's come from, because I think dance, it is difficult to understand. There's no dialogue, there's no text, so you kind of just interpret how you see it.
Mm-hmm. Myself and my friend Cameron once went to see a dance piece. I think you know Cameron, don't you? Mowat.
Yeah, is that your friend?
Yeah.
Oh, 10 foot tall. Yeah, brilliant.
They are brilliant.
Went to see their show last week.
Did you enjoy it? I went to see it as well.
Loved it.
How did you find the little quiz at the start?
I just thought the whole thing was great. It was fun. It was it was curious and what's going on. And the question about, would you run over a family or an elderly couple? Was that in your question?
I think so, yeah. It was definitely a question.
I was sorry, elderly couple, but you're getting the hit.
Yeah. It was a bit weird. Do you wonder what's strange about that was? My friends had to see it on a Thursday night and I couldn't go, so I went on a Saturday, just me and my girlfriend. And I couldn't believe none of my friends had told me. I know it's meant to be secret screen, also, the whole point is not to tell people about it, but I was still a little bit perturbed that they hadn't told me a little bit about what I was
going to see.
But yeah, I thought they might give me a head at least, it's pretty out there. It's a bit of an overall sort of experience rather than just going to see a show, but they didn't tell me anything.
It's brilliant. Yeah. It's so good. Mm-hmm. Because actually that's the fun in it. As soon as the lights come up, you're like, oh, I'm not sure what's going on here. And I thought the way that they marketed it was brilliant. Because mm-hmm. it does, there's lots of curiosity around it. So you're like, what's going on here? So I think 10 Foot Tall are doing brilliant.
Yeah, they are doing well. I remember when they first started out as well, and it... I wouldn't say they were nervous, but you never, sometimes people start these things with the best of intentions and it doesn't work out through funding or whether just, people get busy with other things in their life.
That's it, because the funding climate's so difficult and you've got to kind of take other jobs and other roles to keep the finances coming in, and sometimes there's a stop and a start, but I think they're really, you can see that there's a growth in what
Definitely.
They're doing,
and they've done really well. I think there's a lot of work, but they've managed to do it consistently, which means they're constantly putting stuff out, which is when people start to trust the name of the company.
That's it. Yeah.
But anyway, me and Cam went to see a show that was sort of part music, part dance, it was the first dance thing I think I've ever really seen as an adult, and Cameron said to me after, did you enjoy that? He's like, yeah. And I was like, me too. Neither, but he says I don't go see enough dance to understand really what's, he said that to me, and I was like, thank you, goodness, because I thought I was just sort of wasn't getting it. And he's like, you need to go see, it's like anything, I suppose, you've never listened to any sort of flamenco guitar, you wouldn't understand flamenco guitar. It's the same thing with dance, unless you've seen a certain amount of it, you're not going to really understand it.
That's it. And it's a funny thing, because sometimes you don't need to understand it, but for example, my dad doesn't really come to many shows, but he came to see it with my brother, and he kept nudging my brother, saying, what's the theme and Colin, my brother's just like, just watch it, because sometimes sometimes contemporary dance is just way over your head, and then you listen to what the creative process was and you go, oh, okay, that's not how I saw it, or it's exactly how I saw it. So
I know. Just speaking about that, reminds me, when I was younger, I used to listen to loads of music, and there used to be a magazine that did the sort of behind the lyrics thing, and I used to always be really disappointed because I'd build up in my head what these songs were about, and then I'd read what the artist said they were about, and it was completely different.
And you're like, no!
So yeah, sometimes I agree, sometimes your best just to enjoy it for what it is, and then even if you find out later where it came from, then you've had your own experience already.
That's it. And sometimes you like a wee synopsis at the beginning.
Yeah.
So you go, right, I know what this is going to be about. And sometimes I challenge myself not to read it, and then just to go, oh, and then
try and figure it out.
Yeah.
So how was it translating your own personal experiences into a dance piece? What was the creative process like for yourself?
Well, interestingly, the film, I'll just go back to the film. The film was myself and another dancer, Vince Furr.
Okay.
And this was a really interesting creative process because we had really limited time and we hadn't met beforehand to discuss the project. I'd said it's about borderline, but I hadn't said, we're going to make this phrase, we're going to look at this kind of themes of it. The idea for the film director was that she wanted to film everything, so every conversation. So it wasn't like I could say, right, Vince, we're going to go and work on something about abandonment, or we're going to go and do this, or we made some dance, and then the filmmaker came in. Excuse me. So it was actually, all those conversations were filmed. Yeah. So we didn't have anywhere to run and hide and go, let's practice this bit, which is really, well, it was unique.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the work was improvised, and which was amazing, because Vince and I had never danced together, and it was like fireworks. I just gave him one task, like, we're really close against these kind of walls with slates. And I just said, like, you know, one touch and then there's a reject. And, like, so wherever you can reject the other person. And then all of a sudden, 30 minutes later, we were doing this full-on kind of improvisation, mm-hmm. physical, moving in the space and against the wall. And so when it came to making the dance piece, I had a bit more kind of choreographic
mm-hmm.
Input. So, yeah, so working with themes of... Errol was given the task to work on like chaos, so it's like this continuous, like you're always coming back to the same place, like you're because you can never break through mm-hmm. that old behaviors and like character flaws that you have or self-destructive ways. So he did some really interesting movement around that, where he was continuously pushing through, and it was really fast. And then Davina worked with this idea of being invisible, which was beautiful, really powerful. So I wanted to look at the contrast of you know, two different dynamics.
Yeah.
And then I worked with I kind of played with this idea of push and pull. So particularly in relationships, you know, there's like all or nothing, black or white. So the extremes of both, whatever emotions that is.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
It makes sense to me, yeah, for sure. And just like, if we go down this route, maybe we'll go back to dancing a bit.
Yeah.
Just what are your experiences with borderline personality disorder? We spoke a bit before we started recording, and you said that your first therapy session was when you were 17, but you weren't diagnosed with the condition maybe for, what was it, 20 years?
Yeah.
You said 20 years later?
Yeah.
So, I don't know, do you want to speak about your mental health experiences?
I think if you ask my mother, she would say that I was always quite a sensitive child, quite demanding and needy and quite expressive. So mm-hmm. lots of emotions. So if I felt something, it was like I felt it, like, fully.
Yeah.
So I grew up kind of having that as a personality. I was quite full on, intense. And we were actually brought up in a hotel for about 24 years. Like, we had a farm where we stayed.
Okay.
So I was brought up kind of in the pub trade back in the 80s, 90s.
Okay.
And it was it wasn't a normal 9-to-5 job. You know, it was quite a chaotic upbringing because they worked a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of alcohol around. So, my teenage years, I became quite wild and self-destructive. And it wasn't until I was about 19, like, you know, self-harming and
mm-hmm.
Drinking a lot of alcohol and substances. Not knowing that that was a way that, I mean, everybody does that when they're teenagers.
Yeah.
So it's really difficult because my parents probably thought, well, that's just normal teenage behaviour. But I would disappear for days and not know where I was. And I was very defensive. And I don't know if I was attacking my parents for my upbringing, because the last thing I want to do is, I adore them. And, you know, I understand that things were how they were back then. But I think I probably, personality-wise, would have benefited from a more stable upbringing. So at 19, my mum had contacted the doctor and said, we need to, you know, there's something not right here. So I started seeing a counsellor at Cornhill. And at the time, I would sometimes miss appointments, and
mm-hmm.
I don't think I was really ready to I didn't know myself that I was out of control, and I didn't. So I'd go and engage in one session, and then I wouldn't go to the next, and then I'd go back and forward. I think that's quite normal, because you think, I don't have a problem, I'm fine. So then over the years, I moved to Edinburgh for 7 years, studied dance. That was really therapeutic for me.
Yeah.
And then New Zealand. And when I was in New Zealand for 4 years, I noticed that I was, my behaviours were really very self-destructive. So I stopped drinking for 18 months, but then I'd become obsessed with not eating, and then over-exercising, and then overeating, and then back to the drink, and relationships just really, it's almost like a relationship is like the undoing of me. I'm like Jenga. romantic relationships or intense interpersonal relationships, usually I could be strong, but then all of my foundations will break. So that's something that I'm still learning. And then it wasn't until 2015, when I was just before I was 40, that I had quite a bad breakdown, marriage breakdown.
Okay.
And then I was diagnosed at Cornhill with borderline.
Yeah, and had you heard of it before?
I'd researched it, because I think when you're searching for something that you feel is missing in you, or there's something not right, like the core of you doesn't feel healthy, that you're always looking at what's wrong with me. I'll stop drinking, you try all these different methods and means, and I had read about it, and it was quite striking to me. But I'd gone through a period a few years when I was married that I was quite settled, and I thought, no, it's gone away.
Yeah, it's fine, yeah.
And then, but actually when I went to see the therapist, she said after a relationship breakdown, we often see people who have traits of borderline that come in because they can't handle the rejection or the abandonment or the separation. And
Yeah. Because I had never even heard of borderline personality disorder until recording one of these podcasts, which was quite naive of me as someone who's, you know, obviously writing and putting out things about mental health.
Yeah.
Really, all I'd really heard of was depression for a long time, and this was going back before I was doing this, but the only thing I was really aware of for a long time was depression, you know.
Yeah.
And then through my teens, bouts of depression and stuff, and then it wasn't until I had a bit of a breakdown one day at work that I started to learn about anxiety and learn what panic attacks and stuff were. And then I just sort of ran with those two for a couple of years, and then obviously started doing the podcast, and I was recording one with, I think it was my friend May, and she was talking about, was it my friend Molly? I can't remember which conversation it was, but one of them brought up borderline personality disorder, and I just, even just on the recording, I was like, what's that? Like, I've not even heard of that. And they started talking a bit about it, and that was when I said, I was just like, that sounds a bit like, and then they're kind of like, yeah, I think you might need to go and look into that about yourself. Yeah.
Wow.
And then I did, obviously, the next day or a couple of days later, I was like, I need to go back at it. And then as soon as I did, start reading into it myself, and as I said to you on Twitter, I've not had any diagnosis of it, but as soon as I started reading about it and just reading about those things that you've just been talking about there.
Yeah. Did it ring a bell?
100%. It was like, just... with every sentence I read, I would link back to something that I'd done or something that happened to me, and I'd say, well, that not explains it, but it does explain it almost, or just it makes things make a lot more sense. A lot of things in my life that I'd done or had happened to me and the way I'd responded, I never really quite understood. And I've had specific memories where I've done things and my friends, the Fairy Hill Boys, have pulled me aside and said, what did you do that for? Why have you done that? And would never have been able to explain it. And it doesn't excuse anything.
No. But
for me personally, as soon as I started reading about it, I felt a lot better. And I don't know if I felt a lot better, but it made things a lot clicked into place. So.
Yeah, I agree. It almost makes sense. And some people think that there shouldn't be a label for borderline. Some people think that they shouldn't be diagnosed, or sometimes they don't like that diagnosis. But for me, it was like, oh, phew, this makes sense. And then when you do have, when I say an episode, I think that borderline is for me personally is overwhelming depths of emotion.
Yeah.
So if you feel something, you feel it really like full on. Like sometimes I can, if I even feel that I'm being rejected, I can think things like, oh my God, I can't commit suicide because I'm a mother. I can't drink because I'm an AA and I can't do this. And I can't. So I think all, like the old Lynn would have just acted on it and okay. done something to ease the pain.
Yeah.
And now I go, okay, I need to sit with it. I need to sit with it. And it's like, it's almost like teenager stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean anything derogatory to teenagers but it's that kind of, at 40, I should know how to manage my emotions.
Yeah.
But it hits me, boom, just like I was maybe when I was 15.
Yeah.
Like I have experience at this age of managing them, but for some reason it becomes overwhelming. And there's no, it's almost like you need to do something to distract yourself. And it's normally a negative, destructive thing.
100%.
So that's a learning in itself, trying to sit with emotions.
When you start speaking as well, you say like you hop straight back to like very early years, and that's sort of something I've always done as well. When people say when did like you start to get thing, like I just start to feel like not quite right, and I would go back to like, you know, really young as well, like much like you did. And I think it is really something that is, it's always maybe always with you, and it's not about getting rid of it. You have to learn how to deal with it. Yeah,
it's like management, self management, and it's almost like being in recovery constantly, but depends what level you're at. I mean, I've done a lot of therapy, so I'm at a place where I manage it better,
mm-hmm.
but it's never going to go away.
Yeah, I know. 100%. I mean, yeah. So what was your first like reactions or thoughts once you got the diagnosis? Was it just you were relieved, sort of almost?
Yeah.
Finally, have something that made sense.
Yeah, I was relieved, and then to know that I went on to do intensive mentalization based therapy at Cornhill, which was weekly sessions, group sessions, which were really useful because you were in a room full of people that you could say, oh my God, I felt like that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, did you react like that? Oh, I've done that.
Yeah.
And so there was like a real kind of bonding, because to be honest, until then, I don't think I'd ever met anyone that had it. So to be sitting in a room, it just happened to be all females, that group, but they do have mixed groups. But to sit in that room, you're like, oh my God, I'm not my own. That was really... Yeah, that was really useful.
Well, why do you think it took them so long to diagnose, to get your diagnosis? Because it's a thing, I think, especially with BPD, it's a thing that I've heard time and time again, is that it goes undiagnosed for a long time, and that it's regarded as widely undiagnosed as well, even if they might have diagnosis, to still think there's loads and loads of people out there that would suffer that don't have a diagnosis. Why do you think it's so hard to diagnose?
I don't know if there's part of professionals being that there's not they don't have enough knowledge of it,
mm-hmm.
or if it's that they do know but they don't want to give that person a label.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I look back at my history, I moved around a lot, so you know, if I think about Aberdeen, then Edinburgh, and then I was in New Zealand, then came back to Aberdeen, so my some of the therapy that I had in New Zealand, you know, they wouldn't have known that here.
Yeah.
So I do believe when I was a teenager, though, but probably back then, it's not as wild, it wouldn't have been as widely known then as it is now. But I think that also, you know, all of those, you know, like self-harm, suicide attempts, you know, substance abuse, relationship, all of that, it should be a red warning if there's a professional looking at someone's...
Because
they say, well, they suggest that you don't... mental health professionals don't diagnose it until they're in their 20s, because a teenager will probably exhibit some of those kind of those symptoms anyway, just kind of trying to grow up and find themselves.
So. I'm just going to ask a question, a bit off of it. How come, just out of my own curiosity, how come you ended up in New Zealand?
I finished my degree in dance, and my brother had moved over there, and he was he was living in Auckland.
Okay.
And I just remember phoning him in one day, and he was loving it. And I said, "Ram, you come over and visit once I finish my degree."
Mm-hmm.
And so I moved over there straight after. But I don't do anything by halves. So it's like I couldn't just have a couple of weeks. I was like, "Right, I'm on a flight. I'm away." And yeah, it was kind of the best and worst thing I ever did because I was really far away from home.
Mm-hmm.
But I lived on a little island in Auckland called Waiheke Island. You need to get the ferry across.
Yeah.
And it was so spiritual. And, you know, like, there was this class, this dance free by the sea. And so I did spend 18 months and I kind of, it was a bit like an AA group. And I knew that there was something in that because I would go to meetings and I would speak with people that had messed up because their alcohol. And I didn't think I saw myself as having an addiction to alcohol then, but I would go on big binges. And any time I couldn't cope with emotions, I'd use alcohol.
Yeah.
But I did drink again. But I now know that I am an alcoholic.
Okay.
Because I never had physical, like, withdrawals, but I know for a fact that I can't trust myself when I drink. And so, for me, that's enough to say you're almost, you know, allergic to it.
Yeah. When was it you first sort of had, started to feel you had issues with alcohol?
Oh, probably as a teenager. When it's acceptable to be a bit drunk and crazy, and then as people grow and, you know, and you still keep doing the same things and your life is messed up, like big things happen, and then you realise that, oh, well, I need to take a look at this. But there's a lot of denial. And I think there's a lot of belief that alcoholism isn't a disease, it's a choice, and it is a choice.
Yeah.
But somebody said in an AA meeting recently, which made sense, it was you just assume that everybody else drank like that. Because I remember, and I align myself with drinkers that were like me.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you just kind of seek out those people in situations so that, you know, if you're with people that are similar to you and
you don't stand out.
Well, that's it.
Yeah.
You're not going to go with the, you know, a friend that likes a cup of tea. You're going to go with the one that likes a bottle of wine or whatever.
Yeah, 100%. How was your drinking like, if you don't mind me asking? Did you find your, like, habitual drinker who drank like every day, or was it more just like you go out and have big binges?
Probably more binges, but blackouts. Yeah. That was the serious problem. I would forget. I would lose time. I would just be like, could lose hours and not know what I've done. And I was quite nasty on booze, quite argumentative. So all of that binge, you know.
Yeah.
I noticed that, like, if I was going to an event, I would need to have a few gin and tonics before I went there. I was always drinking faster than everybody. I never wanted the night to end. I could keep going. And it, regardless of the consequences the next day, I was just very much in the moment. And as soon as I took the first couple of drinks, I was, boom, it was like an explosive.
Yeah.
It was like a change of personality.
Yeah.
And then what started to happen was I would be drinking in the evening on a school night more than I should have. And I think had it progressed any longer, I think I would have started to drink pretty. I was never like a morning drinker and I think that some people confuse that for not being an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
Think, oh, well, I'm not on the street, I'm not drinking in the morning. But actually, if alcohol costs you more than money, like it cost me my marriage, and then I think you need to look at kind of what levels you're drinking and why. Because why do you need to drink to that extent and that, you know, excessive?
Mm-hmm. And so when was it you first sort of went into AA? Was it just when you were in New Zealand, or did you start?
Yeah, so I was 29 when I went to the sessions in New Zealand. And then I came back to Aberdeen, and I remember seeing, oh, I'm not going to drink. And my pals and my family were like, I can manage a wine with your meal, you know, if you go out for dinner. And so I didn't have enough. I was like, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
And then I went on a bad spiral when I came back, drinking a lot. And then, after the breakdown of my marriage, I went to the Priory for 3 weeks in Glasgow.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a wake-up call because
it's like a rehab centre,
yeah.
Just in case folks...
Yeah, it's a rehab.
Yeah, don't know.
Yeah, it's a rehab centre.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously I was a mother then, Sophie was one, and I knew that I had to...
Mm-hmm.
I needed to get help, and that's when we looked at the alcohol, and then Cornhill looked at the borderline,
mm-hmm.
and that's when it started the kind of therapy. Like, how do you get well? And I think being a mother really changes it because you can't.
You got a responsibility.
Yeah. To be honest, I know this sounds bleak, but really, when I wasn't with her, I didn't really care if I died, and I know that that's really selfish.
Mm-hmm.
And I think. And that's not because I didn't care. It's like sometimes the pain was too much that I just wanted to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I thought that my family would be better off without me because they wouldn't have the 3 a.m. calls in the hospital or the police station or...
Yeah.
And then when you become a mother, you're like, shit, this is... what yeah. I not only want to... Because I remember when I went to the Priory, they said to me, I said, I'm doing this for my daughter, I'm doing this. And they're like, no. You need to do it for you,
mm-hmm.
because if you don't do it for you, then you'll relapse, and it needs to come from wanting to be well for yourself,
yeah.
and that'll spill out in,
yeah.
into your daughter's life.
What was that experience like of going to the Priory? And...
Yeah, the food was amazing.
Always a positive.
They had an amazing chef. Oh, it was pretty tough, because
yeah.
you really had to look at yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And
I suppose some days that's fine. There's some days you sit and like do that stuff all the, like you wouldn't mind doing it all day, but then there's some days you just want a break from it.
Yeah, and like step one is it admitting that your life had become unmanageable through
mm-hmm.
alcohol, and then you have to kind of write all the situations that you've had when alcohol has become a problem. And I looked at it and I went, oh my god, yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's a problem here, and yeah, that was I think that because you were, it's like I mean I went home at the weekends from Glasgow to see my daughter, so it was like Monday to Friday, and then I went home and then came back on the Monday, and so that intense being away from your family and away from everything was really positive because you're completely in that zone
yeah.
for that amount of time. And the thing with alcoholism is that there's loads of guilt and shame around your behaviour.
Yeah.
And I think that people think that selfishly you just... You know, there is... I mean, alcoholism or substance addiction is selfish. And it's a family disease. It's not just, you know... Because everybody's coping with the person that's ill.
Mm-hmm.
But they're ill too because they don't know how to deal with it. So I think going to the rehab centre was good because it was like, right, we're fully focusing on this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was it like coming out of, so that was 3 weeks, did you say?
Yeah.
And what was the your steps from there when you came out? Did you just go, did they have stuff set up for you to go?
Yeah, well, your AA, so then from then on, I would go to AA meetings.
Mm-hmm.
So I continued doing that. And then you just meet friends within AA, and you kind of join in and setting up a group, and so I kind of rebelled against AA the first time because I wasn't quite ready.
Okay.
And then I went out and drank again for a year, and then so now on actually in 2 weeks' time I'll be 1 year.
Okay.
And this
great.
Time it feels different.
Yeah.
Because I accept fully that I cannot drink alcohol.
Do you think that's a big part of it? Is that
acceptance.
There's always a part of you thinks
yeah.
that after a while, like I'll be able to go back and I'll be able to drink normally or
yeah.
whatever, yeah.
And or I think you think, oh, it wasn't that bad because I didn't do X, Y, and Z. And you choose, your mind decides
yeah,
to 100%. Eliminate or erase some of the stuff that. But yeah, I think this time, if somebody said to me, oh, you'll manage a wee glass of wine. I'll go, no, I won't. And if they want to pursue that conversation, I'll just say, whatever you think. But I know deep down in my heart that I can't. It's a difference,
yeah.
I think.
Do you think that's a thing that's intrinsic with maybe being Scottish or even just British, that it's such a big drinking culture that it makes it so much harder for people to break
yeah.
the cycle and stuff?
Well, but I think people use it for everything.
Yeah.
If you have joy or unhappiness, you're tired, you're stressed, you've just had a promotion, what do? You celebrate with wine. Summer, yeah. It's sunny outside, you celebrate with wine. It's raining, celebrate, you know.
Yeah.
So it's the go-to, mm-hmm. and it's kind of socially accepted. And I think people that have alcohol problems, they kind of hide that to the world. So mm-hmm. once it becomes obvious that you're drinking too much, you then recluse and go, I'm just have to drink in my own home then.
Mm-hmm.
But it's different for everybody.
Yeah. Just, I think it is a massive part of the culture in Scotland and in the wider sense of UK. It does play a massive part into what, because it's so socially acceptable in one sense, but then just like you say, it becomes, especially in Scotland, there's such a contrast with what, I mean, alcohol sort of appears in almost all walks of life.
Yeah.
But then there's like such a stigma towards, like, you know, the classic word in Scotland is like jakeys and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that becomes like a sort of point of ridicule and a point of like shame. But then it's the same people that would put that on someone else that are out, you know, binge drinking. This is a massive thing in student culture and stuff. And I've started to hear about like people from like European teenagers have come over from France and Germany to experience like the part of big British now. It's become that sort of intrinsic with British culture and stuff. And then people who look down on that are maybe, you know, older people, middle-aged people who at the same time themselves would sit at home and drink
whatever. That's it.
And everyone's sort of pointing the finger at each other and not looking inwards.
That exactly. Yeah, it's almost like, well, I'm not as bad as this person, so I'm okay.
Yeah.
And so that's your defence mechanism, because you go, oh God, I mean, I'll never become that, or at least I don't drink like that person. And then that becomes your excuse to, because one of the things that we were looking at last week in the AA was that people are coming in sooner before they lose jobs. There was one of the prayer books that said, you know, people are coming in before they lose their family, their jobs, their money, their career, because they're able to see that actually this is going to go down a bad, which is positive. And it doesn't always happen, but like I came back into AA last year before I lost everything. And it wasn't like I was, nothing was out of control, but I knew that I had a conscience because I'd been in AA before, and I knew that some of my patterns and behaviours were coming back again.
Yeah.
And also if you have borderline, remove all of those things that are negative. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Remove the alcohol, because that's just going to antagonise both of those, you know.
Yeah. You sort of said like a few times throughout the time we've been speaking about patterns and like cycles and stuff. And I know what you mean with that in terms of BPD, but do I just talk a bit more about that? I think, everything becomes sort of circular when with your behaviour, and you repeat things over and over, and then every time you do it, you tell yourself it's the last time, sort of thing. But I don't know. Do you want to talk a bit about how you feel about that?
It's interesting because I think that borderline is emotional reactions to people, situation, and things. It's not like bipolar where you have like a, you can have like a manic, you can have a high and then you can have a low.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like it comes from the heart rather than the brain. Or although you can have manic moments. And I think, I noticed recently, I wouldn't have noticed it before had I not gone through therapy. I noticed it's a reaction to something or someone, like, oh my God, I've offended them, or they don't like me, or especially stress. If I get overstressed, then I'm like, I can't cope. But also I sometimes overwork so that I don't have to feel, but I don't know that until I look back and go, oh, Lynn, you were using work to not look at something.
Yeah.
Oh God, it's, cycles of, kind of patterns of doing the same things. You know that it's not going to get a positive result, but you can't cope, so you do it anyway.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think I feel like it, like I said, I don't like to speak about it as if I know that I've got borderline personality disorder, because I've not been diagnosed, but I feel like sometimes when I feel like in that sort of mindset, like I feel very, like I become a very spiteful person and just become like, I lash out sort of emotionally.
Yeah.
And like I'll do or say things to people, or I'll feel myself start to change in a way that I know that inevitably I'm going to regret, but I almost like can't stop. And I remember once sitting, and I can't remember 100% right now what was that happened, but I just there was a few things that happened, and I just felt like everything was a way to go completely to shit. And I remember almost sitting, it almost felt like I could see my own like sanity and the sort of walls I built around myself where I felt sort of safe. It just felt like I could almost like see it spiraling down the drain.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I'm just the way to start. Go back to that person I was a year ago where I just didn't recognise what I was doing and just continued to go.
And do it anyway.
Yeah.
I get that.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like, that's why I think it comes back to emotion, is obviously that overwhelming, that's the only way out that you can see.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
And it's like, maybe you've done it before, but you're like, I can't, it's like a waterfall of emotions, yeah. Like just comes crashing down.
Mm-hmm. And I think as well, you get this sort of weird like voice in your head as well. It's like, well, people expect it of me now anyway. People, I've done it before. People, like, they were fine once, so like they won't. They're not gonna. As much as there's issues around abandonment, I find like I'll test people to the very brink of what like they're willing to accept from.
Yeah. Because you're gonna leave me anyway.
Yeah.
You're gonna leave me, whoever you are in my life, and then you set about pushing them so that they do,
mm-hmm.
and then you go, I told you anyway. That is really hard stuff to control, because it's almost like now, for me, I've got a conscience, I know better,
mm-hmm.
and I know that I can't do that, because that's unfair on the other person, and that so then you need to try it a different way. Mm-hmm. It's almost like, it's almost like sometimes you're grieving for the old person because you can't do what you used to do.
Mm-hmm.
So you're like, oh my God, how do I sit with this emotion? Because I used to do X, Y, and Z, and now I have to try it a different way. You know, and it's mm-hmm. almost like retraining your behavioural patterns.
Totally.
But every day is a school day.
Yeah. Do you feel it's easier to deal with now without the alcohol as a factor? Do you think
that? Most definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. Listen, I would have a therapist at all times. if I had the money, that's what I'd do if I won the lottery. I believe that if I feel things, I mean, the AA, because I can go to however many meetings a week I want, that really is help. That really helps.
Because
mm-hmm. even so, AA is not just about removing alcohol, it's about all the emotions that made you drink.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's perfect.
Yeah.
And then you don't have the shame after a binge, and then you do other things that would then cause you to self-destruct. It's almost like trying to make your life as stable and healthy as possible to then manage emotions.
Mm-hmm.
But there's one thing as well that, like, people with borderline get a bad, kind of bad rap in the media or like, and I actually think that it can be your superpower if you use it correctly. Like, mm-hmm. I have got abundance of energy and motivation,
mm-hmm.
and my work with, like, you know, borderline, with the dance and the film, and that for me is really healing and therapeutic, and that's where I should put my obsessive energy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying obsessive, take that word out.
Yeah.
Constructive energy. Yeah. But, and also that I have a lot of empathy for others. So I can feel people's feelings.
Mm-hmm.
I also want a lot of, I like peace, where I didn't used to, because I don't know how to get that, but I'm interested in people. Like, so like you doing your podcast,
yeah.
You're interested in people's journeys, and so mm-hmm. am I. I find it really fascinating. I find people fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Now, someone I recognise, I don't know, I wouldn't have associated that so much with a mental health thing. I just think I just remember my mum was always like very into reading about people. She always used to read all biographies, but not of famous people, of people that had been through like painful experiences of like, you know, child abuse, or just had like these painful things happen to them and gone through it, which I think, thinking back, that was like quite a big thing for a few years, maybe when I was 12, 13, 15 years ago, there was a while where there was all these books coming out that people were writing. But I just remember around that time, my mum absolutely loved it. So I don't know if that's opened me up to listen, or want to speak to people about their experiences. But
that's good.
Yeah.
Good job, mum.
My mum always appears in every 1 in 5 podcasts.
Oh, does she? Good for you, mum. Yeah. It's good for young people to be able to express their emotions, because we don't teach coping skills at school.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the thing that you need all through your life.
I think young people are getting better at that, though.
Yeah.
I think as the culture changes, it'll naturally settle down to young people.
Yeah, and I think men as well are being able to express themselves without it being like a kind of unmanly way of, you know. I think, it's quite different for men and women.
I think it still is as well, and I follow quite a lot of like stuff on, you know, Instagram and Facebook, like mental health, like pages that'll make like funny memes about mental health, which some people I suppose don't agree with because they don't think it should something to be laughed at. But for me, I just find it hilarious. I think the more sort of
you
can have fun with it, the better. But I've noticed a lot of those are geared towards more like females than they are for men. So that was just something that realization I had this morning. Was looking at through them, was that a lot of them still are geared towards females. So although there is more stuff with men, I think there's still maybe on the mass consensus that men aren't, it's not integrated in the male culture quite as much yet as in the female. But I suppose it will get there, because it moves in that direction.
Yeah, it's still there, isn't it?
Yeah.
That men, I'm really lucky because my brothers, both brothers, they're, I call them emotionally available. Yeah. And so you can talk about anything to them. They're pretty open-minded, and well, they've had to listen to me for years. So, but generally, it still needs work. That, you know, men can be vulnerable and open up, and that's okay, and you don't have to hold it together.
So, one of my last questions is that after doing the last project, if you got any ideas, or would you want to do more stuff with mental health through dance? In the future, is it something you've thought about, or?
Yes, definitely. A couple of ideas that I've got is, one is to create a piece of physical theatre, play piece on borderline personality disorder, and kind of the code of where it comes from. So I had a meeting yesterday with the theatre director, so we're chatting about, you know, what does that look like, and see if we can get some funding to kind of spend some time researching what that'll look like.
Because
up until now, I've kind of just got little pots of funding for myself to work. So it'd be great to get a team of experts together, you know, director and musician and actors and dancers. So that's the next step. And also, I'd like to tour the film in the Northeast.
Mm-hmm.
So, the film was screened in Banksy and then in Aberdeen, but you know, places like Peterhead and Fraserburgh and Banff and smaller community, rural communities that kind of don't sometimes get access to this.
Yeah.
And whether that's alongside a piece of live dance or it's just a film or
I suppose you could just do the film in the Q&A
as well. So most definitely.
I've got an idea, but I'll speak to you about it after.
Okay.
Off mic. And just the last question I always ask everyone, but it generally, quite often it leads to more stuff, so I always try and ask it early in case we end up doing another 15 minutes or something. But just, what do you do now? What are your sort of coping mechanisms to deal with anything mental health related? And what would you suggest to anyone? Maybe something that you found helpful that isn't maybe as conventional that they maybe wouldn't have thought of to try?
For me, it's definitely not isolating, talking to friends or family if I'm going through a bad patch, so that they're aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
And because isolating and going into your own head is a dangerous place, because your head will tell you things that sometimes you don't need to hear. So actually getting it out, I've got a few friends who know me within an arts context, or friends, or like a friend, they know my whole life, and they're really, really helpful in saying, Lynn, it's all okay. It's just they ground me. So talking, and whether I'm saying friends and family, but for example, AA group, friends, meet friends there, and if support groups locally is really useful. Sometimes I journal, so write out all of that negative stuff. It's like a stream of consciousness, just writing that stuff that gets stuck in your head. Well, for me personally, it's dance, being an advocate and raising awareness of you know, alcoholism or BPD. That is really healing for me because it means I get to go out and speak to people that have suffered similar things. And so I think that I'm possibly helping them and they're helping me in return. I think if you were to remove the work that I've done with the film and dance, I think I'd be a bit lost. So it's fine. Do you know what it is? I think for me, healing was doing something meaningful and purposeful. So, and I'm not saying that anybody should leave their job and, you know, but I think like, you know, go and find those things that make your heart sing. Because before, the things that were I thought that made my heart sing were pretty negative, and actually turning those, I think that everybody should live with something, doing something they're passionate about or work towards that. And for me, that happens to be dance and the arts. But for somebody else, it might be sport, it might be, you know, being outdoors, it might be skiing or whatever it is. That it's just finding that thing that you can you can touch and it becomes meaningful, and being around people that have the same kind of drive in terms of healing. I mean, for me, I remember, well, just recently I did this vision board, you know, it's like putting pictures and quotes of what how I'd like to see the next few months, and I found one that said, make peace of mind and serenity your main goal and then work around that. Because I think for me, I never had peace of mind. I was always searching. What was I searching for? I wasn't sure. But actually, you know, I think once you kind of find something that's meaningful, then you can start. Oh, I don't know, I'm just blabbering now. I don't know. For me, I find meaning, which is being the dance and film and reaching out to others. And as my mother always tells me, routine. You know, like routine is something that seems so obvious, but for me, it's like, you know, I know on a Monday, Tuesday, and Friday I work, or you know, on a Wednesday I put up the kids, and I'm doing, you know, I just finished my masters, and so all of that is like.
See, it's interesting. For a long, long time, I thought I really rebelled against routine. I thought I'm not the kind of person that could ever have a routine, like. That'll never make sense for me. I'll to just do what I want when I can, like whenever, and I need to have different, you know. Whereas now, having fallen into a bit of routine, not only, like I used to think routine meant being boring. Whereas now I've realised that routine, it doesn't make you boring. It actually means you can, even this answer sounds boring, but it means you can fit in so much more of what you want to get done. And you're much more productive
with it
when you've got a routine. Whereas before I thought routine meant that you had to productivity.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
I agree. Yeah, I kind of rebelled for many years against that. And I know that when I'm not in a routine, I can see myself going, where's my direction? And then I go, And that lovely feeling, which is going to your bed at night and having a clear conscience, that is priceless. That is that you're doing the right things, you're being kind to people, you know, you're not always going to get it right. None of us are going to get it right. But it is nice going to bed and saying, I've got a clear conscience. I haven't messed up. I'm a good person or good enough. And being a good mother. And then you can sleep at night.
Well, I think that's a perfect note to end on anyways. So thanks very much, Lynn, for speaking to me.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Amazing. It's great. Thank you.
No worries.
All right. How did you find that one? As I said at the start, I think I gushed a little bit at the start. I absolutely loved this episode, recording it, and I'm really excited to hear what everyone thinks of it. Yep, absolutely loved it. I don't know who your guest will be next week. It might be one person, it might be many people. I'm going on the road again. That was terrible and cheesy. But yes, I'm going back out on another little run to record podcasts. Think of my poor lure. That's quite a thing of poor taste to say, but I don't even think my liver would be the correct person to think of. I think, or the great thing to think of even, my lover is not a person, it's part of a person, which happens to be me. Think of my poor sleeping part, just my body in general. I'm just going to be so tired. It's going to be exhausting, but I'm looking forward to it. Of course, there's a little bit of football involved as well. It's not all business. Not that recording these podcasts is strictly business. I do obviously really enjoy doing it as well. What a load of shite I'm warbling today. Yeah, thanks for listening. Thanks to Lynn. And as I said, I've got a few episodes I'm recording this weekend, and I don't know which one I'm going to put out yet. Hoping to get a Christmas episode recorded soon as well, so that'll be coming to you in the next couple of weeks. And yeah, hopefully we solid podcast with guests right now, right up to through to New Year and for a good while after as well, and you won't have to listen to any more of my solo efforts, although I did quite enjoy them. In fact, we're recording a group podcast this weekend, and I think we will definitely be playing Emotion Roulette. So that's one positive that's been born of the solo efforts, that people seem to enjoy us playing that little game. Anyway, thank you so much for listening, and catch you next week. Cheers.